Welcome to Day Zero Update for November 17th, 2024. I'm your host, Chris Elogi.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Daniel Victoria.
And yeah, it's another holiday week of the holiday season here where not much is really going on. We do have some stuff happening, but it's more industry news this week. And some other stuff kind of going on, but not really much in the way of big news, which isn't really too much of a surprise since we're less than a month away from the Game Awards, and that's kind of where we expect the majority of news for things that are going to be happening in the next year or so going to be happening. But we still got some stuff here to talk about, as well as just some new games, as we've been playing some of that stuff. So yeah, before we get to the news, we'll be talking about what we've been playing, and I'll kick it off here. I've been playing some Tetris Forever. I managed to grab that, and that has been very fun so far. It's not really, I don't know if it's telling too much surprising stuff about the story of Tetris, which is a game that was created by Alexei Pajitnov in Russia. And sort of knew it was good pretty quickly, and managed to find a way to get it ported to other platforms so that they could potentially start selling it and making some money off of it.
Yeah, that in and of itself is a whole story, because basically there was like basically like two or three different companies were trying to get the rights to it. And they basically had to like send representatives into the Soviet Union, which even in the 1980s was not an easy thing to do. So, yeah, it's and the thing is, Pajitnov himself did not make any money off of the trademark for years.
You kind of learn a bit about particularly the computer that he made it for, which was the Electronica 60, which not a very common computer platform in even in the Soviet Union. I've seen people talking about like that's a very hard one to find anymore, especially as there are a lot of like tech museums and such. They're trying to gather as much of that stuff as they can, and that is a one of those platforms. I believe they talk about it being kind of a, as you might not be surprised by, like a lot of technology in the Soviet Union is just them ripping off of popular stuff from other countries.
Yeah, pretty much. Or if they did try to do something comparable, it was often like a lot bulkier and tended to break down a lot easier. Yeah. So, yeah.
And the Electronica 60 is based off of, I believe, the same PC platform that Jeff Minter started on, which was not not a very powerful PC. Couldn't really even do graphics, really. So that's why the original version of Tetris has just uses like brackets for its blocks versus any actual kind of squares or anything like that. Because of the rarity of that platform, Digital Clips just basically remade it themselves in a comparable form.
Yeah. That's... I'm looking at the specs for it here on Wikipedia. It was basically it was made in the Soviet Union by the Electronica brand. Which remember in the Soviet Union, basically every company that existed was somehow connected to the state. So Electronica was like a brand that was used by the, that was literally used by the Soviet Ministry of Electronics. So, and, let's see, it was, CPU, it used an M2, an LSI CPU implementation clone. Its memory was, 4 kilobytes, 16-bit words, max about 32K, 16-bit words. So yeah, it was, even by the time period, it was not a terribly powerful computer system.
Yeah, it's pretty much a clone of like a very cheap microcomputer from the UK and all that. So
mm-hmm.
that was kind of what he was working with at the time. And so once it kind of started getting some momentum, he immediately hired somebody to port it over to Windows or
yep.
MS-DOS as a thing as they were starting to get it out there. And then they met a businessman who pretty much had plans for getting it out there and getting licensing stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that he was like going off and signing deals before he even technically had the rights
yep.
to it. And that's kind of a,
yeah. Remember, this is the Soviet Union we're talking about. So if you created something like this, then most of the economic rights belong to the Soviet state. And keep in yeah. mind, this came out in like the thing debuted like in 1985. The Soviet Union would be dead and gone at about 6 years later. So he's unfortunately playing on a very, he's kind of walking a tightrope here. He doesn't realize is there.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they mainly focus on the versions of Tetris made by the company itself.
Mm-hmm.
The Tetris company, which I believe all these are from, I forget what their full name is, but it's PBS, not the
yeah.
public broadcasting system, but
no.
it's their version I'm trying to see if I can find it here. Let's see. Yeah, I'm not sure where it's at, the full name, but they are the ones that kind of got the rights and were sub-licensing it out to a bunch of different companies.
Yeah.
Which is like the one knock against this entire collection here is that the amount of companies that have had the Tetris license and made Tetris games over the years is sort of too vast to really be a super comprehensive collection.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when Nintendo is one of those.
Yeah, Nintendo, basically, I think they started releasing their own version, and I think it was right around 1988, 1989, and they yeah. basically kept doing that until, like, 1996. And the thing is, they can't really reproduce the Nintendo version, because anybody who played the original NES version of Tetris knows that Nintendo's branding is all over it.
Yeah.
So much so that there's like a whole ending sequence with Mario and Luigi and, you know, all of them doing the Cossack dance and everything. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. So you end up with, it's Bulletproof Software. So BPS, not PBS. And so they were kind of the main stewards of Tetris in the West. Mm-hmm. At this point. And so, yeah, like you don't get the NES versions of any of these games. You get the Famicom. They were still making them for those platforms versus when they got localized and brought over by, you know, Nintendo proper or whoever it ended up being. And so, yeah, the only games you get here are quite a few, though. As you look into it, it's like, okay, here's Tetris for the Game Boy and Famicom, and you also get the MS-DOS version
mm-hmm.
and some other stuff there that is pretty neat. I kind of wish they got some of the arcade games in that, especially since those were, I think, published by Atari back then, which is then when you do the whole weird thing where they then publish their own version of Tetris on the NES, separate mm-hmm. from the Nintendo one, as Tengen was their sort of sub-brand there.
Yep. And
yeah, it is kind of a whole web of mess of companies that have touched the brand.
Yeah.
Which has turned it into kind of a bunch of different stuff going on.
Yeah. Tengen in particular is particularly notorious because they ended up releasing their own version, I think it was either like very shortly before or around the same time that Nintendo released theirs. And yeah. The Tengen is like the Tengen version is very unusual because, For one thing, the Tetris blocks in their version are not like divided up into individual squares. They're like a solid piece.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, I believe they were the first ones to put out a two-player versus mode before Nintendo did.
Yeah. Yeah, so you end up getting a number of variants of the original Tetris, and that is pretty cool to see. Mm-hmm. I believe all the trophies and achievements are just for the original Electronica 60 version, and the new version they made, Tetris Time. So doing various things in those, usually getting scores and whatnot in it. That is pretty cool. Though, yeah, then you, as you start dealing with this, I think the Famicom Tetris one, you see how kind of messed up the controls are. Mm-hmm. Because you don't rotate with any of the buttons. You rotate by hitting, I think, down on the D-pad. And I was like, no, we're not doing this. I just remapped it to how the traditional Tetris is, and that's mm-hmm. whole thing. I think another thing I didn't realize about Tetris is that the score is more based on when you send the block down versus, you know, when you get lines and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Those early ones. So that is where the core of like multiplayer Tetris, at least the high skill competitive stuff is, where they're just dropping those pieces as fast as possible because they know exactly where they're putting this stuff in as they're getting to it. That makes a lot of sense there. But yeah, you get to play these different versions that are pretty cool. And then they introduce Hank Rogers, who is a pretty interesting person who got into working on Tetris through making a Go game for the Famicom, which they include here. That is a pretty cool like addition there that you wouldn't necessarily expect, but that kind of set the framework for what he would be working on for Tetris games themselves on the Famicom, that kind of stuff. And yeah, then they get into Tetris, which is a variant of Tetris I'd never played or really seen before. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of neat, where essentially instead of blocks, it's kind of more like Yoshi, that kind of puzzle game. Yeah. Where you're stacking up these hats, and you're trying to stack up five of the same in a row, or not in a row, in a column, to get them to go, and you get points for that. And that's a neat kind of game, because the designs of the hats, they come up, kind of just use a bunch of different styles to keep them looking unique. Mm-hmm. But the way they stack up is pretty well compact for what is going on there. So yeah, that's a pretty neat one. You get Famicom and Game Boy versions of that. There's Tetris 2 and Bombless, which was one package where you get like a new Tetris thing going on, which is pretty good. Then they have a bomb variant that is pretty cool too. Which kind of starts feeling a bit more like a Puyo Puyo kind of thing, where if you get the bomb parts of the pieces connected, they can line up for a pretty good kind of blast, like combo blast, take out more pieces as you go for that stuff. And then there's like Super Tetris 2 and Bombless, and probably the highlight of the collection for multiplayer stuff here is Tetris Battle Gaiden, just for the Super Famicom. Never got brought over, but it is very much that style of multiplayer puzzle game where you are completing lines, sending junk over, but you get these magic orbs that you collect in those lines that then lets you use one of four spells or abilities that you have against your opponent. And depending on whether you have one, two, three, or four of those orbs, changes what the ability is. And it's a really good, one of those puzzle games where you will probably, ban a couple characters for being just too unbalanced and powerful. But they have some good real good fuck you abilities, where you can turn all the other players' pieces to stone, where they have to match them twice to get rid of them, that kind of stuff, as well as some good abilities for getting yourself out of sticky situations and all that. So, Then there's like Super Tetris 2, Super Tetris 3, Super Bombless, Super Bombless DX, and like a lot of those were Japanese only releases, unfortunately. But yeah, that's kind of where you get for the releases here, and then you get Tetris Time Warp, which is more traditional Tetris game. The thing is that every so often you get a piece that comes down that is like a, I guess like a time warp piece, that when you match that in lines, you get sent back into time to play like older versions of Tetris. So you might get sent down to play, you know, the original Electronica version or the Famicom version, or, you know, what, or Bombless or whatever. And it usually gives you an objective to do in that amount of time to get bonus points. And so, yeah, it's a neat little spin on Tetris for that. But yeah, the story stuff, they do a lot of that for the, for how Tetris started, how it got out of the Soviet Union, and kind of where it becomes a big deal. And there's all these variants of Tetris out there as the license kind of gets all over the place. And then they do one kind of like, here's all the stuff that's, you know, that's come out since the various games in this collection, which, you know, features like the first like Shockwave version of Tetris and the Dreamcast version, the Pokemon version, that's for their little tiny keychain size game system that called the Pokemon Mini. You get your like mobile phone versions and various references in pop culture and all that. And yeah, and then like EA getting the license rights for the mobile version for 15 years, which I think ended in 2021, something like that. Yeah, somebody actually getting the kill screen in NES Tetris, which was something that people weren't sure was ever possible, but
yeah,
somebody managed to figure that out.
Yep.
And a lot more like console versions, multiplayer versions, arcade versions, all that kind of stuff. Going up to the various releases since then, like the DS version, Tetris 99, Tetris Effect, all that kind of stuff that shows where it's kind of been. Even that Chicken McNugget version of Tetris that got released a few years ago. So yeah, kind of it's a very cool kind of overview of a lot of this stuff. I do kind of wish there was a like an unlimited budget version of this that has all those other variants, because yeah, publisher wise they've been all over the place, from Nintendo, Sega had it, EA, THQ, Ubisoft, a ton of companies have had the rights over the years, and it'd be cool to at least have all those different variants. But obviously that's a huge ball of wax, because everybody would want their cut for having their game in this collection, this kind of collection. And that's just not feasible for the sort of budgets that Digital Eclipse is working on. But yeah, it's pretty cool. But maybe they'll have some DLC at some point. That would be nice to see. They've been doing that for Atari 50, and that's been cool to add more games and the documentary stuff. So that's been a fun collection to kind of jump into for that. So there you go for that. The other new game I've been playing is the Rise of the Golden Idol. Playing the PC version. It's the sequel to The Case of the Golden Idol, which I do recommend playing first, because there are elements of that story that ties into this one here. So that one took place in the 1790s, mostly. This takes place in the 1970s. Where essentially is they start telling you that, you know, about the things that happened in the first game, and sort of that over the, you know, 180 years that since then, that it's been disregarded as a thing that's actually happened and been relegated to being just a myth, a made up thing. And then you start doing your thing, looking through these crimes and murders and all that, and you start seeing like, oh, there's some element that maybe the Golden Idol or some new version of it has been found and is being used to do something very weird here, as a number of people are turning up dead with some sort of red curse, as they call it, early on. I'm near the end of the second chapter, so I still got quite a bit to go, but I've been really enjoying this. It's essentially a deductive adventure game of sorts, where you're going through these cases, kind of looking through all the evidence, particularly like clicking on people and seeing like what items they have on them, notes, see what the things they're saying, that kind of stuff. Cool. That makes it gives you a lot of stuff to work on that is pretty comprehensive for everything. Seems like this time around they add more terms for potential outcomes. Like one of the first things you do is you find this guy that looks like he's maybe fallen down these steps and died. And you get, when you click on him, you get things added like, you know, fell down steps or slip down steps or thrown off steps, like that kind of stuff. Where it gives you a little bit more things to work on there. That is pretty cool.
Uh-huh.
And the nice thing is in the original game, the way when you were working on all this stuff, you had these static screens for filling out all the evidence and all that. Here they kind of turn them into more widget type of stuff, like windows that you can move around on the screen.
Uh-huh.
That is pretty cool. So that you can more easily kind of pull up evidence and compare it to what you're trying to fill out, whether it's people's names or parts of like timeline of events, that kind of stuff that's happened. That kind of helps make that a little bit better, a little bit easier, though I still think that it would be better just to let you have like a compendium of all the documents and evidence and such and all the text that goes with that to make it easier to look over what you have here. Yeah. So that is the one knock I have against it, because you can have a bunch of these widgets on the screen at one time, and that makes it a more clustered interface at times.
Uh-huh.
When you're trying to sift through everything that's on there.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of that's the one knock I have for it right now. But yeah, the story has been really good so far as we're working, or as at least I'm working my way through these different cases and trying to piece them all together. And between the different little cases, you have this overarching thing that you can fill out as you go that kind of covers the connective tissue of the story for what's happening in that chapter. And that's a sort of a neat addition here. But yeah, really enjoying it so far. I played mostly on my PC, but I played a little bit on Steam Deck, and it's kind of a huge mess there. The control scheme they have on that is, I would say, just extremely confusing, especially since they don't have options for like showing you what the control scheme even is. So like on a Steam Deck, the D-pad does a couple different things, but when you have like your widgets and all that on the screen, you can kind of move them around a bit with the right stick. You have to use the right stick and the right trigger to grab them, to move them around and arrange them how you want. But if you hit, I think, the D-pads, it'll just recenter those to the left or right side of the screen. In kind of a weird way. That is, yeah, kind of one of those things where if I hit the wrong button, I start messing up the way I have things set up and just kind of getting really frustrated. The left stick controls something else. I forget exactly what it was, because I played it for like an hour and a half on the Steam Deck, and I was just super kind of confused what was going on there. It's just kind of a huge mess of a control scheme that will take you a while to learn it, or you just get around it and just remap everything on the Steam input stuff that makes it a bit better. But I don't think you should have to do that. And it's not Steam Deck verified yet, but yeah, the original on Steam Deck was a bit of a frustrating experience at times. But here it's kind of even more so because, yeah, there's like two different ways to highlight parts of the UI. So you could have your cursor that you're using the right stick for to highlight the like close button on a widget you want to close. And you hit the A button and that activates a different thing that's highlighted because there's the sort of controller highlight. And so I've like removed text from entry fields a number of times just from hitting the wrong button. Cause you're supposed to, if you're highlighting something on the cursor, you gotta use the right trigger versus just hitting the A button. Like you would think you would do in a normal game, but yeah, it's real weird to describe. It's real weird in action, and I would just say it's don't play it on a Steam Deck, at least not without looking up control or Steam input mappings that people have, because I assume those are out there that just simplify it. I've seen people just like just have it set to do mouse actions because that makes it less frustrating, because it's pretty poor the way it is right now, and that makes me curious what the controller experience is, because I assume it's probably similarly kind of confusing. And yeah, this is one of those PC games that doesn't have any settings really. It's just audio stuff and whether you want it full screen or not full screen. That's about it. So I was even having some performance issues where if I was hitting the words widget that has all your terms and nouns and all that stuff. If you hit the sorting button, just say a few times in a row, the frame rate would tank until it figured out what it wanted to do. That kind of stuff that's like, yeah, it was running. My monitor is a 75 frames per second monitor, and it was running at like 145 by default. I was like, it'd be nice to just have VSync and not have this be an issue. But yeah, it's a very good game that's kind of marred by, I assume, trying to make it for consoles at the same time as the PC version, and having more platforms to worry about that use a controller interface that they don't seem to have a good grasp on how to make their game really work on that well. And so it's just kind of a whole weird thing. But yeah, I'd probably just recommend the PC version for people to check out. I don't think it's that intensive of a game, but it's been very good so far from what I've been playing. So that's been that. I'm hoping to beat it this week, so we'll see how that goes. So yeah, that's The Rise of the Golden Idol. And then the other thing I've been doing is I've been playing some Playdate stuff. They had a big anniversary sale over the last couple of weeks, and I managed to buy a bunch of games and got some really neat games. Not really going to go into a ton of them, but some of my favorites that I've been playing from this batch includes like one called Root Beer, which is a game about just literally pouring, I guess, root beer into these glasses. It gives you different types of glasses, from like shot glasses up to like a pitcher, and gives you a randomized sort of line to fill it up to. And if you can fill it up to that, you get a real nice animation of the bear customer that you're serving being real pleased about the perfect pour, versus if you mess it up, they'll get very angry. And if you overfill it, they just almost kind of die of embarrassment that this got messed up so bad. And you get like a Wilhelm scream type of scream out of that, which is pretty funny. But it's a very basic kind of arcade game where you're just doing these pours in, you know, like 60 seconds or whatever it gives you, and trying to earn as much tip off of that. And so I think my best has been like about $81 or so, which pushed me second on the basic leaderboard that they have. Which 100 is the top bears. Like, I think they have names for the bears. Like I beat the cool bear who was at $75. But I think the top bear is the top one at $100. So that's one I'm hoping to get at some point. Let's see. There's Ouroboros, which is like a snake puzzle game. You know, the classic like snake game of moving a snake around to, you know, eat a pill or something like that to extend it. But instead of it being that kind of game, it's a puzzle game where essentially you're trying to eat your tail. Essentially, as you guess from the name, trying to be an Ouroboros. And so like the very early ones, you're in some basic level design stuff where you're trying to get your snake like wrapped around a block so that you can grab onto its tail, that kind of stuff. And every 10 stages, it adds a new mechanic. And so where I left off was the point where they were having little pills that you eat to extend your tail one extra, you know, square. And that adds a nice little variant to the puzzles, as sometimes they have a bunch of those in the stage, and you have to figure out like, okay, wait, what's the right amount? Sometimes you want to eat all the pills, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you want to avoid them altogether. They have some pretty well designed puzzles for this, and it's a fairly small puzzle game, so that's a pretty cool one there. Another one I enjoyed is called Resident Tale. It's very much a Link's Awakening style Zelda game, though there's not much action to it, as the action you do is kind of like an E-style thing, where you're just bumping into enemies to do damage to them, once you get the sword, at least. So yeah, I've gone through the first dungeon. Nice little dungeon, nothing too complicated. I don't think this game is trying to be as big or expansive as a Zelda game, so... But if it gets me a good few hours out of it, that's a pretty good time spent there. And the last one I'll talk about is a game called Satellite that I really liked. It's a tower defense game. Essentially, as you can probably guess from the name, you're kind of putting satellites around orbit on these planets that are turrets, essentially. And the stages are pretty quick, maybe a minute or so of enemies coming in that you need to take out. And yeah, you get money for killing those enemy ships, and you're using that to buy more of these turrets to place around the planet. You have to worry about the rotation and making sure you're going to have all of your lines of sight on the planet covered. Where I'm at, I have the basic laser satellite to a rapid one that is more expensive, but does less damage, but gets more shots in. And then I have EMP lasers that can take shields off of ships, as that's an issue I'm starting to deal with. Sometimes you have just one planet on a stage, sometimes you have two or three. And so it's your job to kind of play around there and see like where the best layouts are for that stuff. Where I'm at, you get, I think, 5 hearts of health to survive. And so far, I've not really had too much trouble with any of that. Letting ships off the screen. They all come from the right side of the screen to the left. So pretty simple setup. But yeah, there's some cool play date games. But yeah, that's been pretty much what I've been doing. So Brandon, how about you?
Well, as for me, I finished God of War. And that game absolutely it finishes in just the best way possible, and it actually goes out of its way to like establish the reality that all these different mythological traditions in the God of War universe, they do actually exist. So like, you know, when you played the original trilogy, that was all, you know, the ancient Greek mythos. So you're thinking suddenly he hops over onto Norse myth. And then at some point you're thinking, okay, if the game's going to remain consistent, it's going to have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, all these different, you know, mythologies actually exist. And it does. The game actually goes out and says, yeah, so all these different pantheons, it's not just ours. There's also the Japanese pantheon and the Chinese pantheon and the Mexican and the Egyptian and all these others. And yeah, it's like actually really cool. And I also just, you know, love the game sort of setting up, you know, how the sequel is going to be. And unfortunately, the sequel is not on PSN, so I'm going to have to wait a little while till I can get a hold of it. But in the meantime, I went back to Media Molecule's Dreams, and I started playing Train again. And I've gotten further into that game. And yeah, that so like the already from the very beginning of that game, as easy as it seems on the surface, it's actually extremely, it can be very finicky because it uses semi-realistic physics. So, you know, the little train that you're playing on the tracks, it has a boost option, but because it's still, you know, a little miniature battery-powered train on these wooden tracks, if you go too fast, obviously, you can end up turning over or, you know, derailing or just crashing. But at the same time, there are parts later in the game where it's not just you playing the little train anymore. You've got to hook up to other the little train cars and carry cargo from one place to another. And that makes it even more precarious because now it's not just you. You're also dealing with these additional train cars that can not only, you know, spill their cargo if you take a turn too fast, but they can also dislodge off the track and eventually drag you off of it. So, yeah. And that's just like the beginning, because later on the game starts, again, all these really neat sort of secondary applications that you can use. Eventually it'll introduce like the little helicopter, which has like a claw on it that you can use to pick stuff up from the environment and carry it over onto the track. There's also a crane. There's even like a huge, like a big ship that you can load the train into and eventually sort of take it over to like other parts of the environment where there are other tracks laid out. It's you know, the game is like super chill and yet it's also a lot of fun. So yeah, that's Train, and it's been very enjoyable. I also have been started playing A Hat in Time, which for those who didn't play Hat in Time back in the day, it, you know, a couple years ago, it was a indie game that was heavily inspired by Super Mario Sunshine. And also, like with Super Mario Sunshine, the camera is kind of ass. It just is. And I'm not sure if that's specific to the PSN version or if that's like an issue for all of them. But especially starting out, the Y-axis is actually reversed. So you basically have to go into the options and visibly shift them, you know, back to where it should be, like any game should. And on top of that, I'm also still going through the ROM of Metal Max Returns on my PC. Not really much to talk about there because I haven't really gotten to it a whole lot. But yeah, that's basically what I've been playing. So, Danreb, what about you?
Yeah, so I finally finished Metaphor Refantasio.
Yep.
And man, it was a heck of a time. I think like when I talked about it last, I was at the almost at the end, and then like last week I had like the worst amount of progress because I was ham-fisted by the tower dragons.
Yep.
And they were really hard. The first one I got, or I mean the first one I chose to fight was who I thought would be the easiest one because he was nearest to the town earlier in the game, and this one was he was a B-word, man. Like he had this move. I mean, I complained about it before, but I complained about this one move that would pretty much give you four more turns. This guy had six, and he kept using it, and it didn't matter like how much HP I had. It was just a quick way to like one hit me every single time, and it was rough going. Eventually, like what I did was I left. I went ahead and just did the final dungeon, and like I was so happy that when I finished the dungeon, you didn't have to fight like the main final boss yet. You still had some more days to chill. So that was a good way for me to grind without grinding the same tower over and over. And I went ahead and swallowed my pride. I bumped the game down to easy, and then I went ahead and took out the dragons that way. However, it's worth noting that the second and third dragons were actually much easier than that first one. Like I was so prepared that I had like all my guys like equipped with stuff that'll re reduce slash damage whenever the dragon would blow fire at me, like it would reflect that fire and all of a sudden end their turn, which really like left me no reason to heal. It was pretty much easy spinning. And then like not to say too much, but after you beat those dragons, there's one more, and it wasn't really a dragon, and this thing had a one hit kill, and it turns out like he's super aggro with the one hit kill when you have a character that has equipment that'll repel. And then I found out that when I deactivated that, it was a whole lot easier, and I actually had an easier time with that boss than I did with the original dragon I faced after putting it back on the normal mode. So anyway, I got to the last part, and I was like, "Oh, so this is what they're doing with it." And like, I think Brandon knows what I'm talking about in regards to like knowing the real identity of like one of those people you talk to. And it's funny. So did this happen to me earlier in my playthrough as well, before the shit really hit the fan? We talk about things like fantasy and whether it's real and whatnot. And what happens is I'm pulled back into this conversation, and all of a sudden you're giving dialogue choices. Now, one thing that I really like about this game is that most of the dialogue choices you have are actually going to be spoken, because you are not actually the protagonist. You are somebody that guides the protagonist's thoughts in the game. And for the sake of being funny, I always chose the stupid answer because there was no point where the game actually like punished me for it. And this is why I like this is what I like about it over a game like Persona. In Persona, if you say the wrong thing, you're gonna go backwards with a lot of your friendships. With this, it didn't really matter. It didn't really waste your time. But I got to a point where this crazy twist happens. I say the stupid thing, and it gave me the credits. It gave me the credits. I was able to skip them, and I was like, okay, this is probably just a meta way to go ahead and make fun of what I did and just go ahead and take me back to where I got to. When it took me to the credits, it ended up taking me back to the start screen, and I had to fight the last boss all over again. So when you get to the end, don't fuck around. That's pretty much all I have to say about that. I will say that Metaphor Fantasia was definitely worth all the hype. After playing it, at the same time, I would also say that it's one of the most annoying games I've ever played. I've never yelled at an RPG as much as I've yelled at this one. At the same time, I've never beaten an SMT game, so that just shows my skill there. And if I had to like compare it to Persona, I would say that I like Persona a little better, mainly because I do prefer the modern day school setting. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of the stories with all of your social links or compadres were just better in Persona. I felt like a lot of the characters in Metaphor fell flat. The only ones I really cared about were Maria, who's the little girl you meet early on in the game, and then there's this other character. I forget his name, but Brandon, he's the one with the faker archetype. Really enjoyed that guy. There was someone else that I'm trying to remember. He wasn't one of the main characters, but just really enjoyed that aspect of it. But compared to a lot of the RPGs, I'm not sure if this was the the best one I played, but at the same time, with the 90 hours I spent, it was a good time. And the battle system really sings once you figure it out. I was doing a lot of different things that you wouldn't be able to do in Persona, or you know, you wouldn't be able to do it now, such as give an enemy a specific weakness so that, you know, someone that you wouldn't even think is a tank all of a sudden becomes a tank. I remember like really enjoying using Heisme and all that, but like my ending party didn't even really use him, which was unfortunate. But I also know it's also because of like the way you want to use your archetypes. But yeah, I do enjoy the archetype system. I think it's really cool where when you master something, or if you master something and you still level up, you end up being given an item that you can use to go ahead and raise your archetype points in another class. And that's pretty cool. I don't know if I'll find myself like coming back to this game to get the platinum, but it was definitely an enjoyable experience, and I'm looking forward to whatever Atlas has next. Anyway, Dragon Quest III HD 2D Remake came out this weekend. I've started it. I didn't put too much time into it. I've only spent like 3 minutes playing it because, you know, I just finished a long RPG. I need some time. So another game I started was Last Time I Saw You. This game is published by Chorus Interactive, who publishes a lot of like similar stuff. Like a Space for the Unbound is another game that I really liked. I really compare it to. And basically this game is a side-scrolling narrative game. And I don't really know what's happened to this one, but I'm really enjoying the visuals. You end up using this East Asian kid who's like looking for somebody, but I haven't really gotten that deep into it yet. The main thing is that, you know, you're doing these various fetch quests. The first thing you do is you got to buy fish for your parents, and then everything goes day by day. I've heard this game is about 6 hours. So I'm looking forward to playing this game as a palate cleanser before I really jump into Dragon Quest III. But yeah, that's been about it.
All right.
All right. So yeah, let's get to some news. First up here, we have a new PlayStation Plus game catalog lineup. That has some pretty interesting stuff here. Let's see. Yeah, for PS5 and PS4, GTA 5 has returned for a few months. So we'll see. People can check that out for the holiday season there. Let's see, for PS5 and PS4, Dying Light 2, Stay Human. So people can check out that one for some good zombie killing action. Then also for PS5 and PS4, Like a Dragon Isshin. Get the sort of retro, you know, Yakuza action there. Set back in the 1860s in Japan. As you get some characters that are very much archetypes of the that one's pretty good. Let's see, for PS5 and PS4, MotoGP 24, another, you know, one of these motorbike racing games. So that's one you can check out. For the PS4, they are offering the Sims 4 DLC Island Living. So if you're playing that free-to-play game, you can check out that DLC now. I've got some more beach stuff to do. Also for PS4, Digimon Survive. That's the weird one where they had its part visual novel, part tactical RPG. That I don't think really was had too many fans interested in it. But yeah, you can check that one out. For PS5 and PS4, Overcooked All You Can Eat. That is the big bundle game that has all the content from Overcooked 1 and 2 and all the DLC stuff. So you're going to have that all in one package there. Make it easier to kind of play all that stuff. Then for PS4, Stick Fight the Game. It's one of those kind of couch, you know, co-op fighting game. To play locally, though I think it also has online play, so you can do that as well. There's that. For PS5 and PS4, Clash Artifacts of Chaos. This is a weird game. It's set in the Zen Clash world, but this is a sort of first-person Souls-like game. So it has all that weird art style to it, and all the weird stuff going on. So that's That's one I've heard decent things. Let's see, PS5 and PS4, Killer Frequency. This is like an 80s slasher game of sorts, but you are sort of the person that is running a DJ radio station kind of thing, and you're getting calls in from people that are potentially being hunted down by a killer. So you're kind of answering their calls and kind of trying to help people out, I guess. They describe it as a bit of a horror comedy kind of thing, so that's neat. For PS4, Hungry Shark World. That is that's an Ubisoft game, I believe. Sort of one of those games where you're just fish eating other fish. Kind of fairly kind of basic kind of casual game. So that's and then one more here for just the extra tier. Chivalry 2 for the PS4 and PS5. That's the big multiplayer first person melee action game. Some cool stuff to it, so that's one you can check out. And then that's it for the extra tier stuff. Here that's for premium members. There is, let's see, PSVR 2 Synapse. That is a dual wield shooting and telekinesis kind of game. Seems pretty neat for that. And then we got some classics here for the PS1. Blood Omen Legacy of Cain. Head of the remaster collection of Soul Reaver 1 and 2. This is a top-down action adventure game. So a bit of Zelda, but more mature stuff going on there, and some good old vampire action there. Then the PS2 Legacy of Cain Blood Omen 2. That was an early PS2 game and Dreamcast game and all that. It's more of a third person action adventure game, but I've heard good things about both of these. I don't know how easy they're to get into with no knowledge of any of it, but I'm sure there are guides out there you can use if you need it. And a bit of a surprise here, they're adding new PS3 stuff. These are streaming only. Resistance Fall of Man and Resistance 2. Both good Insomniac first-person shooters, so that'll be neat to have some new stuff there. First stuff they've added there, and we're celebrating the Ratchet and Clank anniversary a couple years ago. But yeah, we'll definitely fuel the people that want a Resistance Trilogy remaster collection, but at least there's an easier way to play those now without a PS3. So yeah, there's your lineup there and some pretty neat stuff.
All right. I'm definitely wanting to try Legacy of Cain. That's one of those games I've been wanting to play for a long time, but you know, it basically you could only play it on the PlayStation. So
yeah, I'm there with you. That's not a game that I've played back then. It's interesting though that, you know, they're bringing this out like a month before the remakes and remasters. So it'll definitely be a cool experience seeing how they've changed. I just hope that, you know, either one is hopefully they've aged well. I'm not sure. I just know that the PSX in general has just not a generation that aged well. But yeah, there really isn't a whole lot for me from this particular collection this month. The highlight is obviously Grand Theft Auto, but you know, at this point doesn't have that game. And also on a lesser point, the Digimon game. I know it hasn't had like the most fanfare as of late, but I don't remember everyone like saying this game was terrible. So that's might be a game I want to try if I have time to do it. Probably won't, but you know.
But yeah, that's your stuff that'll be available on Tuesday the 19th. So not too far off. We got a couple games here that got dates. Let's see. There's Locomotive. This was in one of the Switch directs. Or the Indie World Directs, whatever. It's supposed to be a comedy adventure game of sorts where you're on a train and you're trying to solve puzzles and do all that stuff. Seems like a pretty cool looking game. It's coming to Switch and PC on November 21st. It'll be $18 from publisher Chucklefish. That's one of those games that looks pretty solid there. So I'm hopefully get my hands on this week. We'll see. But yeah.
All right.
And the other game here, Infinite Nikki. is finally got a release date on PS5, PC, and mobile December 5th. It'll be out. Yeah, it looks like they also have some pre-order bonus stuff or pre-order bundle stuff that you can pay $10 and get some extra in-game currency and materials and such. Mm. I don't ever find those to be all that worth it unless you just have $10 to burn. But looks like it should be a free-to-play game when it launches here. So that'll be cool. This is the one that's shown up at a couple of Jeff Keighley shows that is kind of a chill life sim kind of game where you're exploring and having fun and little adventures, I guess, doing all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently it's a fun ongoing series. I haven't gotten a chance to try it, but whenever I've seen those previews on the various events, I've definitely had some interest. So I want to see if I can hit them up and see if I can like get a code or something. I know it's free to play, but you know I want to get some nice stuff in there.
Yeah. So yeah, that's cool. Let's see. I think that's it for the dates. But we do have some more news here. First up, we got a big surprise update for the GTA Definitive Edition trilogy that came out was a pretty big disappointment. They did improve it somewhat, but it seemed like a project that was not funded very well and very much rushed out to meet a deadline.
Yeah,
and the weird thing is that For the Netflix mobile app, they also put out that trilogy, and it seemed to be a lot better than the ones that people paid for on consoles. So people are like, what the hell happened here? Well, it seems like they have essentially ported all of the or most of the improvements from that to the console versions now and PC versions of the trilogy, which is pretty cool. I played a little bit earlier to just see how it looked, and definitely looked a good bit better. They sort of fixed a lot of the issues with the glitches and bugs and the excessive use of clouds and visual filters and all that kind of stuff that just kind of made it look much different than the original games did in a way. And so it seems like this has made that a much better experience there. So that's pretty cool to finally get it, which, it's cool to see. Because those are, fundamental games to understanding, like, where we are at with games in general, because those were three of the most influential games of the 3D era of games. And, they set a high bar for everybody else to try to compete with and making open world games and whatnot.
So much so that after the games came out and became popular, that pretty much every developer and their mother was either trying to make a GTA clone or was pivoting whatever project they were working on at any given time into a GTA clone. Look at what happened to Jax 2. Yeah, those games are incredibly influential. And, in some ways, still kind of hold up pretty well. But, this collection definitely needed some fixes.
Yeah,
I mean, these games held up very well. It's just that, like, when they were first released, it just didn't seem like much work was done to really make it fit on the platforms it was put on. And it's really unfortunate because, obviously Grand Theft Auto Online makes a lot of money for Rockstar to the point where, like, they don't really have to be doing much. I mean, they've waited three generations to even announce six, and so it happened there. But at least they fixed them, and, I don't know if I'll jump in, but it's happy to hear it.
So, yeah, that's the good news here. More good news. Half-Life 2 is 20 years old. Mm-hmm. As part of that, Valve has announced a number of things to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Half-Life 2. One of them is that Half-Life 2 is free on Steam for the weekend. So by the time you hear this, it'll probably be over. But hopefully you checked it out. Yeah, they put out a big update that I believe just folds episode 1 and 2 and some of that expansion stuff back into the main package.
Yeah.
So you don't have to download those separately.
Mm-hmm.
At least if you don't want to. As well as adding Steam Workshop support to the game so that you can have your mods more easily handled there.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm going to assume is going to be mostly skibbity toilet shit in there.
I mean, we do live in the age of brain rot.
Yeah.
But
since that all spawned out of Gmod stuff.
Yeah, it all came out of Gmod stuff. But much like with the first Half-Life, Half-Life 2 is endlessly moddable. So, you know, that's at least a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to see what other... They improved visuals a bit, fixed some bugs, added some new visual options and all that. So that's cool. Yeah, it looks like they put out a new documentary about the 20th anniversary. I think from NoClip, which is Danny O'Dwyer's documentary channel on YouTube. Very good stuff. So that's cool. Mm. Get some more documentary stuff, because I think one of the biggest sort of documentary features about that game actually came from Jeff Keighley with his feature that he did for GameSpot back in the day.
Yeah,
that is a good look at sort of the making of that game as he was kind of embedded in there to see how everything was going.
Yeah.
His one about the Portal 2 is also really good.
But yeah, the more recent one, the more recent documentary, they actually end up revealing like a bunch of the stuff that was going to be in episode 3, before, you know, they decided to cancel that and focus on, you know, Steam support.
Yeah.
At this point, Valve only makes a game when it's made to like promote a new platform, you know. They put out Half-Life Alyx to promote, you know, Steam VR.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is what it is.
And I think Gabe Newell sort of also acknowledges like that they fucked up just kind of wanting to put too much on that third episode and just not make instead of just making, you know, the third.
Yeah, just making Half-Life 3. Yeah.
Feature
creep. It is something that you have to worry about.
Yeah.
When you're developing.
Valve seems to have this habit of wanting to like a sequel to be like a generational evolution of a thing versus just, we said there was going to be a third episode, we should probably just make it.
Yeah.
And not be like, it has to be a step above.
Yeah, and keep in mind, like, doing that is not a bad thing. I mean, Nintendo has been doing that for pretty much its entire existence, but they skipped several generations working on episode 3. Like,
yeah, and it's not like they don't ever make like expansion content, because they did a bunch of that for Half-Life.
Oh, yeah.
I did some of that for Half-Life 2 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, they really shouldn't have been as big of an issue for them, but they just, whatever it was, they just were not happy with whatever they were coming up to finish that.
Yeah.
And that obviously has left a weird, you know, black mark on them. It's like, well, here's the one failure we have in most of the existence of their company.
Yeah.
That's cool. Some stuff to check out. And I believe it's also Steam Deck verified now. So that's good. So yeah, you can check that out and see how well it still holds up.
All right.
Let's see. Yeah, here some good news about former Capcom veteran Hideaki Itsuno, who we knew left the company a little while ago. Been wondering what he's doing, and it seems like he has joined Lightspeed Studios, particularly to head up their new studio, their Japan studio, essentially called Lightspeed Japan Studio. They are a subsidiary of Tencent Games. So yeah, they're very much, you know, another one of those companies that has a ton of money and has managed to lure away some big name Japanese developers to work on something new for them. It seems like they have two locations in Tokyo and Osaka, working on some big budget action games, which he has one that has a lot of experience in it as one of the main Devil May Cry developers for much of the more recent releases in there from Devil May Cry 3, 4, and 5, as well as the Dragon's Dogma games and a bunch of other stuff. Power Stone 1 and 2, Project Justice, Darkstalkers Chronicle, One Piece Mansion, fighting games and such, and Auto Modelista. So that'd be cool to see what new thing he's working on. There you go. Let's see. Here's some good PC news. GOG has announced their new program, I guess you would call this. Mm-hmm. It's called the GOG Preservation Program. That is a self-aware determination to return the company to the roots that it had, which, as they originally called Good Old Games, GOG. Yep. Now it just doesn't technically stand for that, but they're kind of going back a bit on that. But essentially, they were making a way for you to play old games legally on modern platforms, not have to necessarily go through fan patches and all that kind of stuff to get them working on, you know, Windows 7 or 8 or 9, you know, or 8 or 10 or whatever. They made that much easier. And this is sort of a program where they are essentially committing to preserve and maintain these classic games that are in the program for as long as they exist. There are currently 100 games listed for this program, with a pledge to use the company's own resources to maintain their compatibility with modern and future systems, which is a cool thing to see. That's something that can easily become an issue, as is common on Steam for older games. Because I've had some where I'm like, oh, I want to check out what was it? It was some game that was released like in the PS3 generation and not too old, like 13 years old at this point, but it just would not launch on PC. Even if I looked through the forums and found like potential fan patch stuff to add to the installer that would supposedly make it work, and never really could get it working. And being kind of just disappointed by that kind of stuff. And this seems like their commitment for the stuff that's on GOG to kind of make that much easier for people and not have to force them to go hunting for fan solutions, which is great. So yeah, that is a very cool program to be starting. So yeah, you have to go on to GOG and find the full list there, but yeah, it is pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, like, it makes a lot of sense. I was never like a completely PC gamer, but I remember, like, you know, some games back in the day that I enjoyed playing, mostly point and clicks out of some developers back then. And yeah, it's really like weird to have newer computers and not be able to play that old stuff. And I don't know, to me it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, considering like it can obviously run it, and you know, just there's just reasons why you can't. So a program like this sounds awesome.
Yeah, especially if you go back to older PCs, it's a lot of issues with the way that the hardware ran at that point, where you're making games for sound cards that don't really exist anymore, graphics technologies that don't really exist anymore, that are just folded up into things that people can do, and just OS changes as, you know, companies come and go that make the various components and computers and all that kind of stuff that just evolves over time. That can make some of these games just not run well, and others just run fine. But you also get people spending a lot of time investing into emulation of just DOS and all that. There's a lot of like fun little emulation stuff that just like, oh, we emulate, you know, Windows 3.1, and you can just run the game there. Like, it's native game, and it's like, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Mm.
But also, not everybody wants to do that. Yeah, this is cool for preservation on PC stuff. So there you go for that. And also, speaking of more preservation, it seems like fans of Epic Games, more like the their earliest games, Unreal and Unreal Tournament, have managed to get the permission of Epic Games to archive the games on Internet Archive. They essentially link to specific pages on Internet Archive to offer those two games as ones that you can just download for free and play to your heart's content and not have to worry about somebody coming after you for that. So they, yeah, they link to a website specifically that links to this stuff. So the assurance that they are legit versions versus what can happen on Internet Archive, nefarious stuff. It's not too. Yeah, that's cool. Unreal Tournament especially is a very cool game. It still plays really well. But yeah, kind of games that show you what multiplayer used to be like before.
Yeah,
you had your XP bars and matchmaking and all that.
Yeah, it was basically this and Quake. pretty much. So, yeah, really nice that, you know, people have access to these older games. Especially Unreal, when you consider the fact that that's actually the birth of the Unreal Engine. You know, which, you know, so many developers basically use in their own games. It started with that, with these two games right here.
Yeah. Definitely that and Quake were like the two games that kind of pushed what 3D could do for first person shooters, the competitive space and all that. So yeah. They were also very, very modular.
Oh yeah.
For people to do lots of total conversions and maps and all that kind of stuff, though. I forget what the map is, the classic Unreal Engine or Unreal Tournament map is, the Facing Worlds, I think it is. So they're just these two big hunks of land that are kind of connected by this little strip of rock that you can just snipe at people from, you know, the other side of the map. But yeah, that's cool. That's great to see those things are going to be available to people for the foreseeable future. So great. We do have one bad story of the week here. Developer Tequila Works has filed for insolvency. Seems like they have just run out of money. Do not have any prospects to kind of keep the company going. And yeah, said the general manager, Terrence Mosca, said he was proud of what the team had accomplished together, but prolonged market conditions means they had no option but to file for insolvency. So yeah, that's the developer of Rhyme, as well as some other games. Let's see what else. Guilt is the one they made recently that was for Google's streaming service, which shows you why that did not do well for them. They also co-developed and published the Sexy Brutale. They did get investment from Tencent, but seems like that money did not do them well for the long term. Just ran out of money and no more funding at this point, as a lot of companies are not interested in doing right now. So yeah, it's a sad end for a team that seemed very high on potential early on. With the stuff they were working on, like Rhyme. That was a game that kind of hit big when it was first announced and kind of just disappeared for a while until it eventually, and still was well regarded. But yeah, it didn't seem like they found too much more success after that. Weren't able to kind of sustain that success for the future, unfortunately. Yeah, they worked on Guilt for Stadia. And then did one of the League of Legends spinoff games that probably also did not do very well. So yeah, that just not much good luck for them, which is unfortunate. There you go. But yeah.
Yeah, it's sad, but you know, What can you do?
Yeah. But yeah, that seems like it's going to do it for the show this week.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you to Brandon and Danner for joining this week.
Yeah.
We'll be back with a new episode next week, and hopefully some more good news and all that. And yeah, if you enjoy the show, feel free to let friends and family know. They should check it out. And it's like strangers that are ready for more holiday-like weather. The summer-ish weather has lasted far too long for my taste, and good to finally see it cool down a bit.
Yep.
But yeah, looking at what's coming out this week, there's Microsoft Flight Simulator 2024 for Xbox and PC. That My Sims bundle is also going to be out for the Switch. Let's see. Genshin Impact comes out on Xbox this week, so that's good for the waifu lovers on Xbox.
Yeah.
Stalker 2 is out this week on Xbox and PC.
Mm-hmm.
So those people can be excited.
Yep.
Let's see, for the 21st, the G.I. Joe game, the side-scrolling brawler is out on consoles. I haven't heard much good on that one from the PC version. Locomotive, as we mentioned, is on sale, it's coming out, and On Your Tail is also out on the 21st. That's the
sort of cozy detective story game.
Yeah, like an Italian village.
Yeah, one I've actually been kind of looking forward to. We'll see how it turns out.
Yeah, that seems like pretty much it for the major stuff. So yeah, that's some neat stuff to look forward to. But yeah, if you enjoy the show, let people know to check it out. And we'll be done here and heading home and enjoying a day, week off here till next week.
Yeah.
So we can see what games pique our interest and hopefully have some more good news as we head into the holidays. Thanksgiving is at the end of the month this year, so that's at least good.
28th, actually.
Yeah. So we'll be doing some stuff that weekend as we only got one more show this week, this month. We'll be doing December 1st and having to deal with Game of the Year and all of that. So yeah.
Boy.
At least the holidays won't be clashing with any of our show times, so that'll be good.
Thank goodness.
Those are just smack dab in the middle of the week.
Yep.
Means they'll fuck up all your work weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you all for tuning in. Hope you have a good week ahead. We will see you all next time. Have a good one.